This is the Best of Public Radio from NHPR. New England-based novelist Lois Lowry was the featured speaker recently at the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. Author of the novel The Giver, the film adaptation of which recently premiered, she spoke about her philosophy and the process of writing. She then answered some questions from the audience, as read by the Lyceum's moderator.
You've spoken about, you know, how your words move young people, and I'm wondering about teachers, because these books are so often taught in middle schools. I'm wondering what advice or what concerns you would have or what you would like to say to teachers.
Well, the main thing I would like to say to teachers is that you are way underpaid, and I admire you so much for hanging in there. I put books out there, and they leave my hands and my office and my desk, and then they leave the publisher and go into the bookstores, and they don't belong to me anymore. They go into the hands of readers, and often there's a conduit in the form of a teacher, and I so admire. I hear so often from kids with questions, and sometimes it's the email that says, please tell me all the similes and metaphors in this book. I need it by Thursday. But more often, it's thoughtful, provocative issues and questions raised by teachers who, like me, don't try to answer the questions, but to help the kids answer them themselves and to raise the questions. I don't have any advice on how to teach. I've never been a teacher, but I do admire them.
What was it like trying to get the details of The Giver onto the screen? And what was it like having to change parts of The Giver when it was adapted to the screen? I'm also getting questions about whether you like the movie.
The book was published in It won the Newbery Medal in 94, published the year before that. In 1995, Jeff Bridges contacted me and said he wanted to make a movie of it. And so, you know, his people and my people then did the legal stuff, and he owned the option to make the film. He wanted to direct his first film and star his father, Lloyd Bridges. And he thought it would be an easy movie to get made because the book was already very popular. It was in all the schools. It had won the Newbery Medal. However, it was also acquiring a certain amount of notoriety. It became a controversial book. Some parents wanted it banned. And that perhaps was the thing that prevented the movie from getting made. And so time passed, and it just never got made. Every now and then, Christmas would come, I'd get a Christmas card from Jeff Bridges, but nothing happened. And until 2 years ago, and I'm jumping over some intermediary stuff, but 2 years ago, suddenly the time seemed right, probably because other dystopian books had been written and made into movies like The Hunger Games and Divergent, I think is the name of one. And so The Giver seemed quite tame in comparison to them. There's no violence in The Giver. The Weinstein Company, Harvey Weinstein, came in and said, yes, we'll finance this movie. From then on, it moved at full speed. Jeff was then old enough to play the role of The Giver, which he has done. They consulted me right away, though they had no obligation to. I was very gratified that they sought me out, asked my advice about things. They showed me screen tests. They did tell me, and I had no say in this, that they had decided to make the ages of the kids a little older. In the book, the three kids who are the main characters, are 12, and in the movie, they're teenagers. That was based on market research that shows that teenagers, a large part of the movie audience, will not go to a movie about 12-year-olds. So they'll go to a movie about 16-year-olds. So I said, well, okay. I said, but please, please don't turn it into a teenage romance. And they promised me they would not. And they've shown restraint in that regard. However, it is clear that in the book, of course, the boy begins under his tutelage with the old man, the giver, who's giving him the memories. He begins to feel things which he has never felt before. Of course, he's 12. If he's 16, 17, and has this beautiful young actress playing his best friend, of course he's going to feel romantic feelings for her, and that is in the movie, but it's handled with great restraint, and I don't have a problem with it. They also had to add visual stuff, action. Much of the book takes place within the interior of the boy, within his thoughts, and a movie can never be the same as a book. There have been some notable exceptions, and one was To Kill a Mockingbird. But it was clear that this was going to have some things added, and it has. They also got Meryl Streep to play the role that is very small in the book, and because they had Meryl Streep, the role is larger, and she plays it very, very well. So they filmed it in South Africa. I went over there at their invitation and expense to watch the filming, and then after the filming was done, the final scene in the book takes place in snow and hills, and I was hoping they would film that part in Maine, where I live, but it's filmed in Utah. It's very beautiful. Maine was more expensive. They don't give filmmakers the breaks that Utah does, apparently. Any rate, and then they invited me down to New York to watch the post-production stuff, and that was what I found the most interesting, the editing of the film, the putting it together, the adding the music. The score was written by a guy who graduated from Brown, which is where I went to school, just a minor, non-important detail. But any rate, it all goes together like a jigsaw puzzle, and I got to be privy to watching that happen. And the movie opened August 11th in New York, and there I was on the red carpet with paparazzi, but then they were all dutifully yelling at me and taking my picture, but they were really just waiting till Meryl Streep appeared. But at any rate, I loved the process. I loved being part of it. I found it fascinating, and I like the movie very much. There are things that I would have done a little differently, but I'm not a filmmaker. I did argue with Harvey Weinstein. Nobody argues with Harvey Weinstein, apparently, but I had nothing to lose, and I felt strongly about this one thing, and so emails flew back and forth between me and Harvey, and I lost because he's Harvey and I'm not. And the movie was costing $30 million, and none of that money was mine, so he won. And so there is one aspect of the movie that I wish I had won that battle, but I didn't. The funny thing is, now it can be told, I was instructed /ordered not to mention publicly in interviews about my battle with Harvey Weinstein. And so I didn't. Bad press. But the other day, and I never watch TV in the daytime, but I had a guest at my house who had to get up early to catch a plane. He left, I poured a cup of coffee, and I flicked on the TV, and it was the Today Show, and there was Harvey Weinstein, and he was saying my name. So I left it on. And he was saying, yes, she was very cantankerous. So I figured he outed me, I'll out him and say he was kind of cantankerous too. We ended up friends, I think. He would like, he says, to make a movie of Number of the Stars, but it's in the hands of somebody else right now, and so they'll have to deal with that between them. But at any rate, I think the movie did a good job of maintaining the integrity of the book. I've seen it now 3 times, and every time I've seen it, the audience has clapped, applauded at the end, which I don't think they do at every movie. The memories that the giver gives to the boy in the book are described in the book, but in the movie, of course, they're visual. And I found that profoundly affecting. When the boy decides, I'm sorry, if you haven't read the book, you don't know how this works, but the boy decides to leave the community, taking a baby with him in hopes of changing the way things are in this dystopian world. And the giver, who has given the boy some of the memories of the past, says to him, I'll give you memories of strength to help you on your journey. And so then there are these images go by, and one of them is the image of the young man standing in front of the tank in Tiananmen Square. And one is Nelson Mandela. I found that sequence of images very, very moving. And that is not in the book. It's something that I think is enhanced in the movie. The reviews of the movie have been mixed. The New York Times hated it. The Washington Post loved it. Denver loved it. San Francisco loved it. Someplace else hated it. So I don't know what that says. It says everybody comes to it differently and sees different things. And some of the reviews say they want it to be more like the book. I think it does a very good job of staying with the book.
In the 2 decades since The Giver was published, have the questions and messages from your readers changed? The questioner also wants to know how the digital age has altered the sensibilities of young readers as you perceive them.
Okay, hold that second part in your mind because I'll forget it by the time I finish answering the first part. And that was about the questions and have they changed. I think the moment of the great change in response to this book came after 9/11. The book was published in 93, and so then by 2001, 9/11 happened, and we in this country had to make compromises of our freedoms in order to try to get some security. I think that affected greatly the kinds of questions I got, because the book is about a community of people, larger in the movie than in the book. And in the book, it's probably the size of Peterborough, New Hampshire, perhaps, who have given up essential freedoms in order to be comfortable and safe. And then, of course, in reading the book, you realize that they've made terrible compromises. So I think that became more apparent to the book reading audience after we had to answer those questions about our own security after 9/11. Okay, the other half of the question was about computer.
The digital age and how it might have altered the sensibilities of...
Well, I think we've all been observing how the digital age has changed young people's reading habits, and mine too. I carry a Kindle around with me because I travel a lot. I read fast. I used to carry a canvas bag filled with books. Now I carry an iPad. I would still prefer to hold a book in my hands, but I'm grateful to have that electronic device. However, I'm troubled by watching... Well, okay, I'm going to out my own grandchildren. I got a text message from one of my grandsons, 12 at the time. Hi, Oma. They call me Oma because I have family in Germany. Guess where I am? I text back, I don't know, Mars? He replies, ha ha, no, I'm in the car coming back from New York. We went to a bar mitzvah in New York. And he lives in Maine. So I said, oh, that's a long drive. I hope you have a good book. His reply, which kills me, was, I don't need one. I have my iPod Touch. I don't even know what that is exactly, but I don't think it involves a reading experience. I think it's probably games. So we've all seen this happen to our kids. I think, though, that what even a game does is allow you to enter a narrative and a story. And I think the thirst for stories will always be there. I think it's inevitable that the vehicle for providing them is going to change. I think books will remain. I say that only because I can read nothing but my Kindle, but I don't, and I still have bookcases filled with books because there's something special about books, and I hope my grandchildren will grow to have that same appreciation, and I think they will, probably because of their parents. Okay, that was the last question, right?
That's the last question.
Thank you all.
To listen to Lois Lowry's lecture again and other lectures from this year's Monadnock Summer Lyceum, visit nhpr.org. Next week, the Best of Public Radio goes back to school with a new series of documentaries about the American education system from American Radio Works. That's next Sunday night at 9 on the Best of Public Radio on NHPR.